The financial problems that arose from Esther's marriage to the blacksmith, which deprived Joe's company of a quarter of their income overnight, and from the weeks the other girls had been laid low by dysentery, were so major that Joe nearly lost the house. But the thought of seeing her doves working for the competition spurred her to keep fighting adversity. They had gone through hell, and she could not let her girls slide back into that life, because much against her will, she had become fond of them. She had always thought of herself as one of God's serious mistakes, a man condemned to the body of a woman, which is why she could not understand the maternal instinct that had budded when it was least convenient. She looked after Tom No-Tribe religiously, but she liked to point out that she did it like a sergeant. None of that mollycoddling, it wasn't in her nature, and besides, the boy had to be strong like his ancestors. Babying only screwed up a kid's manliness, she warned Eliza when she found her with Tom No-Tribe in her lap, telling him folk tales from Chile. This new tenderness for her doves was a serious stone around her neck, and to top everything off, they knew how she felt and had begun to call her mother. Her gorge rose at that. She had forbidden them to do it, but they ignored her. We have a business relationship here, God damn it! I can't put it any straighter. As long as you work, you have a salary, a roof, food, and protection. But the day you get sick, get lazy on me, or I'll get all wrinkled and gray, so long, she groused. Nothing easier than replacing you. The world is full of easy women. And then, all of a sudden, here came this syrupy sentimentality to foul up her life, something no madam in her right mind would ever permit. All this crap happens to you because you're a nice person, Babalu the Bad teased her, and it was probably true, because while she was wasting precious time nursing sick people whose names she didn't even know, the other madam in town had refused to let anyone who was sick come near her place. Joe was getting poorer, while her rival put on weight, had her hair bleached, and took a Russian lover 10 years her junior, with muscles like an athlete and a diamond set in one tooth. This competitor had expanded her business, and on weekends, the miners lined up at her door with money in one hand and hat in the other, for no woman, no matter how low she had sunk, would put up with an undoffed hat. Very clearly, Joe maintained, there was no future for her in the profession. The law didn't protect them, God had forgotten them, and all she could see ahead was old age, poverty, and loneliness. She considered taking in washing and baking pies to sell, meanwhile holding on to the trade in gambling and dirty books. But her girls were not interested in earning a living with such hard and badly paid work. This is a shitty profession, girls. Get yourselves married, go study to be teachers, do something with your fucking lives. Stop hanging around me, she sighed sadly. Babalu the Bad, what's more, was tired of acting as a pimp and bodyguard. Their sedentary life bored him, and Joe Bonecrusher had changed so much that he didn't really feel like working with her any longer. If she had lost her enthusiasm for the profession, where did that leave him? In desperation, he confided in Chile Boy, and the two of them entertained each other in making fanciful plans to break free. They contemplated organizing a traveling spectacle. They talked about buying a bear and training it to box so they could go from town to town, challenging anyone brave enough to duke it out with the animal. Babalu was looking for adventure, and Eliza thought it would be a good opportunity to have company while she looked for Joaquin Andieta. Besides cooking and playing the piano, she didn't have much to do at Joe's place, and the inactivity was making her out of sorts. She wanted to feel the freedom of the open road again, but she'd grown fond of these people, and it broke her heart to think of leaving Tom No-Tribe. The boy was reading well now and was diligent in learning to write. Eliza had convinced him that when he grew up, he should study to be a lawyer and defend the rights of the Indians instead of avenging the dead with bullets, as Joe wanted him to do. You will be a much more powerful warrior that way, and all the gringos will be afraid of you. He still didn't laugh, but once or twice when he sat beside her to have her scratch his head, the shadow of a smile played over his angry Indian face. Dao Chen walked into Joe Bonecrusher's house at 3 in the afternoon one Wednesday in December. Tom Notribe opened the door, invited him into the parlor, empty at that hour, and called the doves. Shortly thereafter, the beautiful Mexican came into the kitchen where Chile Boy was kneading dough to announce that some Chinaman was asking about Elias Andieta. But Eliza was so preoccupied with her work and with remembering her dreams of the night before, in which there had been a blur of gambling tables and pierced eyes, that she didn't pay any attention. "I am telling you that some Chinese man is waiting for you," the Mexican repeated. And then Eliza's heart kicked like a mule in her chest. "Dao!" she screamed and shot out the room. When she got to the parlor, however, she found a man so changed that it took several seconds to recognize her friend. His cue was gone. He was wearing his hair short and combed back with brilliantine, round eyeglasses with wire frames, a dark suit with a frock coat, a three-button vest and flared trousers. Over one arm was an overcoat and an umbrella, and in the other hand he held a top hat. "God in heaven, Dao! What happened to you?" "In America, you have to dress like the Americans," he smiled. In San Francisco, he had been attacked by three bullies, and before he could pull his knife from his sash, they had knocked him out for the pure fun of mopping up a celestial. When he came to, he found himself in an alley, covered with filth and with his queue cut off and wrapped around his neck. At that very moment, he decided to wear his hair short and dress like the Fan Wei. His new aspect made him stand out in Chinatown, but he discovered that he was much better received outside it, and that doors opened that had been closed to him before. He was possibly the only Chinese man in the city who looked the way he did. A queue was considered sacred, and the decision to cut it proved that he did not intend to go back to China, but rather to stay in America, an unpardonable betrayal of the emperor, his country, and his ancestors. His clothing and his haircut, nevertheless, were also the source of a certain awe, for they indicated that he had access to the world of the Americans. Eliza could not take her eyes off him. He was a stranger she would have to get to know all over again. Dao Qian bowed several times in his usual greeting, and she did not dare indulge the impulse to hug him that was burning inside her. She had often slept cuddled against him, but they had never touched without the excuse of sleep. "I think I liked you better, Dao, when you were out and out Chinese. I don't know you now. May I smell you?" she asked. He stood very still, uneasy, while she sniffed him like a dog its quarry, at last recognizing the faint sea scent, the old comforting odor. The haircut and severe tailoring made Dao look older. He had lost his lackadaisical air. He was thinner and seemed taller, and his cheekbones stood out in his smooth face. Eliza observed his mouth with pleasure. She remembered perfectly his infectious smile and perfect teeth, but not how voluptuous his lips were. She caught a somber expression in his gaze, but thought it must be the effect of his glasses. "How good it is to see you, Dao," she said as her eyes filled with tears. "I couldn't come any sooner. I didn't have your address. But I like you now, too. You remind me of a grave digger, but a handsome one." "That's what I'm doing now," he said, smiling. "Digging graves. When I heard you were living in this place, I thought you were fulfilling Azucena Placere's prophecy. She said that one day you would end up like her. I told you in my letter that I earn my living playing the piano. Incredible. Why, you never heard me. I'm not so bad. And if I could pass for a deaf-mute Chinese boy, I don't know why I couldn't be a Chilean piano player." To his surprise, Dao Qian burst out laughing. It was the first time in months he had been happy. "Did you find your lover?" "No, I don't know where to look anymore." "Maybe he doesn't deserve for you to find him. Come back with me to San Francisco." "I don't have anything to do in San Francisco." "And here? Winter is coming. In a week or two, the roads will be impassable. This town will be cut off." "It's very boring to be your stupid little brother, Dao." "There is a lot to do in San Francisco, you'll see. And you won't have to dress as a man. There are women everywhere now."
"What about your plans to go back to China?"
"They're on hold. I can't leave yet. Sing-song Girls. In the summer of 1851, Jacob Fremont decided to interview Joaquin Murrieta. Outlaws and fires were the chief subjects of conversation in California. They kept citizens terrorized and the press occupied. Crime was rampant and police corruption common knowledge. Most of the force was composed of crooks more interested in protecting their partners in crime than the local populace. After one more raging fire, which destroyed a large area of San Francisco, a vigilante committee had been formed by outraged citizens, headed by the ineffable Sam Brennan, the Mormon who had spread the news of the gold. Companies of firemen pulling water carts by hand ran uphill and down, but before they reached a burning building, flames would be leaping from the one beside it. The fire had begun when Australian hounds had splashed kerosene all through the store of a merchant who had refused to pay them protection money and then torched it. In view of the indifference of the authorities, the committee had decided to act on its own. The newspapers clamored, "How many crimes have been committed in this city this year? And who has been hanged or jailed for them? No one. How many men have been shot or stabbed, hit over the head and beat up? And who has been convicted for that? We do not condone lynching, but who can tell what an indignant public will do to protect itself?" Lynchings were precisely the public solution. Vigilantes immediately threw themselves into the task and hanged the first suspect. The numbers of these self-appointed enforcers grew day by day, and they acted with such excessive enthusiasm that for the first time, outlaws took care to move about only in the full light of day. In that climate of violence and revenge, the figure of Joaquin Murrieta was on the way to becoming a symbol. Jacob Fremont took it upon himself to fan the flames of Murrieta's celebrity. His sensationalist articles had created a hero for Hispanics and a devil for Americans. Murrieta was believed to have a large gang and the talent of a military genius. It was said that he was fighting a war of skirmishes that authorities were powerless to combat. He attacked with cunning and speed, descending upon his victims like a curse and then disappearing without a trace, only to show up 100 miles away with another attack of unbelievable boldness that could be explained only by magic powers. Fremont suspected that there were several Murriettas, not one, but he was careful not to write that because it would have diminished the legend. On the other hand, he had the inspired idea of labeling Murrieta the Robin Hood of California, which immediately sparked a wildfire of racial controversy. To the Yankees, Murrieta represented what was most despicable about the greasers, and it was believed that the Mexicans hid him and provided him with weapons and supplies because he stole from the whites to help the people of his race. In the war, they had lost the territories of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, and half of Colorado and California, and so for them, any attack against the victors was an act of patriotism. The governor warned the newspaper against the rashness of making a hero of a criminal, but the name had already inflamed the public's imagination. Fremont received dozens of letters, including one from a young girl in Washington who was ready to sail halfway around the world in order to marry that Robin Hood, and people stopped Fremont in the street to ask him details about the famous Joaquin Murrieta. Without ever having seen him, the newspaper man described Murrieta as a young man of virile mien, with the features of a noble Spaniard and the courage of a bullfighter. Quite by accident, Fremont had stumbled across a gold mine more productive than many in the Motherlode. He decided he must interview this Joaquin, if the fellow really existed, and write his biography, and if it were all a fable, he would turn it into a novel. His work as author would consist simply of writing in a heroic tone to satisfy the common man's tastes. California needed its myths and legends, Fremont maintained. To Americans, it had come into the Union with a clean slate. They thought that the stroke of a pen could erase a long history of Indians, Mexicans, and Californians. For this land of empty spaces and solitary men, a land open to conquest and rape, what better hero than a bandit? Fremont packed his indispensables in a suitcase, stocked himself with a supply of notebooks and pencils, and set off in search of his character. The risks never entered his mind. Having the dual arrogance of an Englishman and a journalist, he felt he was protected from any harm. In addition, traveling was, by now, effected with a certain ease. There were highways, and a regular stagecoach service connected the towns where he planned to make his investigations. It was not the way it had been when he had begun his work as a reporter, riding on muleback, forging a path through the uncertainty of hills and forests, with no guide but insane maps that could lead one to wander in circles for all time. Along the way, he could see the changes in the region. Few men had made their fortune with gold, but thanks to adventurers who had come by the thousands, California was becoming civilized. Without gold fever, the conquest of the West would have been delayed by a couple of centuries, the journalist wrote in his notebook. There was no dearth of subjects, such as the story of the young miner, a boy of 18, who after a year's back-breaking effort had gotten together the $10,000 he needed to go home to Oklahoma and buy a farm for his parents. He was walking back to Sacramento through the foothills of the Sierra Nevada one radiant day, with his treasure in a sack over his shoulder, when he was surprised by a band of ruthless Mexicans or Chileans, he wasn't sure which. All he knew for sure was that they spoke Spanish, because they had the impudence to leave a sign in that language, scrawled by knife point on a piece of wood. Death to Yankees. They were not content with beating and robbing him. They tied him naked to a tree and smeared him with honey. 2 days later, when he was found by a patrol, he was raving. Mosquitoes had eaten away his skin. Fremont put his talent for morbid journalism to the test with the tragic death of Josefa, a beautiful Mexican girl who worked in a dance hall. She arrived in the town of Downeyville on the 4th of July, and found herself in the midst of a celebration promoted by a candidate for senator and irrigated with a river of alcohol. A drunken miner had forced his way into Josefa's room, and she had fought him off, plunging her dagger deep into his heart. By the time Jacob Fremont arrived, the body was lying on a table covered with an American flag. A crowd of 2,000 fanatics ignited by racial hatred was demanding the gallows for Josefa. Impassive, her white blouse stained with blood, smoking a cigarette as if the yelling had nothing to do with her, the woman was scanning the faces of the men with abysmal scorn, aware of the incendiary mixture of aggression and sexual desire she aroused in them. A doctor tried to take her part, explaining that she had acted in self-defense, and that if they executed her, they would also kill the baby in her womb, but the mob silenced him by threatening to hang him, too. Three terrified doctors were marched over to examine Josefa, and all three declared that she was not pregnant, in view of which the impromptu tribunal condemned her in a matter of minutes. "Shooting these greasers is not the way to go," said one member of the jury. "We have to give them a fair trial and hang them in the full majesty of the law." Fremont had never had occasion to witness a lynching before, but this one he described in emotional sentences. How, about 4 in the afternoon, they had started to lead Josefa to the bridge where the ritual of execution had been prepared, but she had haughtily shaken them off and walked to the gallows on her own. The beautiful woman climbed the steps without any help, bound her skirts around her ankles, placed the rope around her neck, arranged her black tresses, and bid them farewell with a courageous "Adios, señores," that left the journalist uncertain and the others ashamed. Josefa did not die because she was guilty, but because she was Mexican. This is the first time a woman has been lynched in California. What a waste when there are so few, Fremont wrote in his article. Following Joaquin Murrieta's trail, he passed through established towns with school, library, church, and cemetery, and others whose only signs of culture were a brothel and a jail. Saloons thrived in all of them. They were the centers of social life. Jacob Fremont would install himself there, asking questions, and so began constructing, with some truce and a mountain of lies, the life, or the legend, of Joaquin Murrieta. The saloon keepers painted him as a damned spick dressed in leather and black velvet, wearing outsized silver spurs and a dagger at his waist and riding the most spirited sorrel ever seen. They said he would ride into town unchallenged amid a jangle of spurs and his gang of cutthroats, slap his silver dollars on the counter, and order a round of drinks for everyone in the house. No one dared refuse. Even the bravest of men would down their drinks in silence under the villain's flashing gaze. For the constables, on the other hand, there was nothing splendid about him. He was nothing less than a vulgar murderer, capable of the worst atrocities, who had managed to escape justice because all the greasers protected him. The Chileans thought he was one of them, born in a place called Quillota. They said he was loyal to his friends and never forgot to repay a favor, which was why it was good policy to help him. But the Mexicans swore he came from the state of Sonora and was an educated, handsome young man from an old and noble family and had turned to crime out of revenge. Gamblers considered him an expert Monte player, but avoided him because he had crazy luck in cards and a ready dagger that flashed into his hand at the least provocation. White prostitutes were dying with curiosity because it was rumored that this handsome and generous youth had the tireless cock of a stallion. But the Hispanic girls never expected to find out. Joaquin Murrieta never used their services, but often gave them tips they hadn't earned. They claimed that he was faithful to his sweetheart. They described him as a man of medium height, with black hair and eyes like coals, adored by his men, stalwart in the face of trouble, ferocious with his enemies, and gentle with women. Other people said he had the gross features of a born criminal, with a terrible scar right across his face, and that there was nothing of kindness, breeding, or elegance about him. Jacob Fremont selected the opinions that best suited his image of the bandit, and that was how he portrayed him in his articles, always with enough ambiguity that he could print a retraction in case he should someday meet his protagonist face to face. He looked high and low during the 4 summer months without finding Murrieta anywhere, but from the many different versions he contrived a fanciful and heroic biography. As he did not want to admit defeat, he invented in his articles brief meetings between cock's crow and midnight in mountain caves and forest clearings. After all, who was going to contradict him? Masked men, he wrote, led him on horseback with his eyes blindfolded. He couldn't identify them, but they spoke Spanish. The same fervent eloquence he had used years before in Chile to describe the Patagonian Indians in Tierra del Fuego, where he had never set foot, now served to pull an imaginary outlaw from his sleeve. He was becoming enamored of the character, and in the end was convinced that he knew him, that the secret meetings in caves were real, and that the fugitive himself had commissioned him to write about his feats, because he thought of himself as the avenger of oppressed Spanish peoples, and someone had to assume the responsibility of according him and his cause a proper place in the developing history of California. There was little journalism involved, but more than enough fiction for the novel Jacob Fremont was planning to write that winter. When Dao Chen had reached San Francisco the year before, he had devoted himself to establishing the contacts he needed to exercise his profession of zhongyi for a few months. He had some money, but he wanted to triple it in a hurry. In Sacramento, the Chinese community consisted of some 700 men and 9 or 10 prostitutes. But in San Francisco, there were many thousands of potential clients. Also, many ships were constantly crossing the ocean, and because there was no running water in the city, some gentlemen sent their shirts to be laundered in Hawaii or China, which allowed Dao to order his herbs and remedies from Canton without any difficulty. In San Francisco, he would not be as isolated as in Sacramento. Here, too, there were several Chinese practitioners with whom he could exchange patients and information. He did not plan to open his own consulting office because he was trying to save money, but he could associate with another already established zhongyi. Once installed in a hotel, he had taken a walk around the quarter, which had spread in all directions like an octopus. Now it was a small city with sturdy buildings, hotels, restaurants, laundries, opium parlors, brothels, markets, and factories. Where before only cheap trinkets were for sale, now stood shops of Oriental antiques, porcelains, enamels, jewels, silks, and ivories. Rich merchants came there, not just Chinese, but Americans as well, to buy goods to sell in other cities. The merchandise was displayed in a motley clutter, and the best pieces, those worthy of connoisseurs and collectors, were not set out in plain sight, but were shown in the back of the shop to informed clients only. Down dark streets, some buildings housed rooms where serious players met to gamble. At those exclusive tables, out of view of public curiosity and the watchfulness of authorities, extravagant sums were bet, murky deals negotiated, and power exercised. American law had no bearing among the Chinese, who lived in their own world with their own language, customs, and ancient laws. The Celestials were not welcome anywhere. The whites considered them the lowest among the undesirable foreigners invading California, and could not forgive them for prospering. Americans exploited them however they could, attacked them in the streets, robbed them, burned their shops and homes, murdered them with impunity, but nothing quelled them. The population was divided among five tongs. On arrival, every Chinese immigrant joined one of these brotherhoods, the one guarantee of protection, of finding work, and of assuring that at death one's body would be sent back to China. Dao Chen, who had avoided associating with a tong, now had to do so, and he chose the largest, the one most Cantonese affiliated with. Soon he was put in contact with another Zhongyi, and they explained the rules of the game to him. First of all, silence and loyalty. Everything that happened in the quarter stayed inside its boundaries. No going to the police, not even in the case of life or death. Conflicts were resolved within their kind. That was what the tongs were for. The common enemy were always the Fan Wei. Dao Chen once again found himself a prisoner of the customs, hierarchies, and restrictions of his days in Canton. Within a couple of days, everyone had heard his name, and he began to receive more patients than he could attend. He did not have to look for a partner, he decided. He could open his own office and make money in less time than he had thought. He rented two rooms above a restaurant, one to live in and the other for his work. He hung a sign in the window and hired a young assistant to spread word of his services and receive his patients. For the first time, he used Ebenezer Hobbs' system for following the history of the sick. Until then, he had trusted his memory and intuition. But because of the growing number of patients, he began keeping records to note the treatment at each visit. One afternoon in early autumn, Dao Chen's assistant came to him with an address on a piece of paper and a message to come as soon as possible. He attended his last patient of the day and left. The wooden two-story building, decorated with dragons and paper lanterns, was in the heart of Chinatown. One look was enough to tell him that this was a brothel. On either side of the door were small barred windows where he could see the faces of young girls calling to him in Cantonese, "Come in and do what you will with pretty Chinese girl." And for the benefit of white visitors and sailors of all races, they repeated in indecipherable English, "Two bitty looky, four bitty feely, six bitty dooey," as they exposed pitiful little breasts and tempted passers-by with obscene gestures which, coming from those children, were a tragic pantomime. Dao Chen had seen them many times. He walked down that street every day, and the mewing of the sing-song girls pursued him, reminding him of his sister. What had happened to her? She would be 23 now, in the unlikely case that she was still alive, he thought. The poorest among the poor prostitutes began very early and rarely lived to be 18. By 20, if they'd had the bad fortune to survive, they were ancient. The memory of that missing sister kept him from going to Chinese whorehouses. If he was maddened with desire, he sought out women of other races. The door was opened by a sinister-looking old woman with dyed black hair and eyebrows drawn with charcoal pencil, who greeted him in Cantonese. Once it was established that they belonged to the same tong, he was led inside. All the length of an evil-smelling corridor, he saw the girls' cubicles. Some were chained by an ankle to the bed. In the darkness of the hall, he met two men adjusting their trousers as they left. The woman led him through a labyrinth of passages and stairways that covered an entire block before they descended rickety stairs into darkness. She indicated that Dao Chen should wait, and for a time that seemed interminable, he waited in the blackness of that hole, listening to the muted noises of the nearby street. He heard a faint screech and something brushed his ankle. He kicked out and thought he had hit the creature, maybe a rat. The old woman returned with a candle and guided him through more twisting passageways until they came to a padlocked door. She took a key from a pocket and struggled with the lock until it opened. She held the candle high, lighting a windowless room in which the only piece of furniture was a board pallet a few inches above the ground. A wave of fetid odors struck them in the face, and they had to cover nose and mouth in order to go in. On that platform were a small cramped body, an empty bowl, and a burned-out oil lamp. "Cheka," the crone ordered. Dao Chen turned the body over to find that it was already stiff. It was a child of about 13, with two circles of rouge on her cheeks and scars on her arms and legs. Her only clothing was a thin blouse. It was obvious she was nothing but bones, but she had not died of hunger or illness. "Poison," he determined without hesitation. "You don't say," the woman laughed as if she had heard something very funny. Dao Chen had to sign a paper stating that the death was due to natural causes. The old woman stepped out into the corridor, banged a small gong twice, and a man promptly appeared, stuffed the body in a bag, slung it over his shoulder, and bore it off without a word as the procuress placed $20 in the hands of the Zhongyi. Then she led him through new labyrinths and left him finally before a door. It was to a different street, and it took Dao Chen a long time to find his way back to where he lived. The next day, he returned to the same address. Again, there were the girls with rouged faces and crazed eyes, calling out in two languages. 10 years ago in Canton, he had begun his practice of medicine with prostitutes. He had used them as rented flesh and to practice with his master's gold acupuncture needles. But he had never paused to think about their souls. He thought of them as one of the universe's misfortunes, yet another of the errors of creation— beings who suffered ignominy to pay for offenses in former lives and improve their karma. He felt sorry for them, but it never occurred to him that their fate might be modified. They awaited disaster in their cribs, exactly as a chicken in its coop in the market. That was their destiny. That was the anarchy of the world. He had walked down that street 100 times without focusing on those small windows, on those faces behind the bars or their beckoning hands. He had some vague notion that they were slaves. But in China, more or less all women were slaves. The most fortunate served fathers, husbands, or lovers. Others, employers for whom they labored from dawn to dusk, and many were like these girls. That morning, however, he did not see them with the same indifference because something in him had changed. He had not tried to sleep the night before. After he left the brothel, he had gone to a public bath where he soaked for a long time to rid himself of the dark energy of his sick patients and the deep repulsion oppressing him. When he got to his office, he sent his assistant home and brewed jasmine tea to purify himself. He had not eaten in many hours, but it was not the moment for food. He took off his clothes, lighted incense and a candle, knelt with his forehead to the ground and said a prayer for the soul of the dead girl. Then he sat in meditation for hours, in total immobility, until he was able to isolate himself from the noise of the street and the odors of the restaurant and sink into the void and silence of his own spirit. He did not know how long he sat, absorbed, calling Lin, until finally the delicate ghost heard him in the mysterious reaches she inhabited and slowly found her way, moving toward him with the lightness of a sigh, first nearly imperceptible but gradually more substantial, until he clearly felt her presence. He did not see Lin inside the room, but rather in his bosom, in the very core of his tranquil heart. Dao Chen did not open his eyes or move. For hours he sat in the same posture, separated from his body, floating in a luminous space in perfect communication with Lin. At dawn, once both were sure they would not lose one another again, Lin softly said goodbye. Then the acupuncture master had come, smiling and ironic as he had been in his best days, before he was beaten down by the delirium of senility, and stayed with Dow, keeping him company, and answering his questions until the sun rose, the neighborhood awoke, and he heard the discreet taps of his assistant at the door. Dao Chen got up, refreshed and renewed as if after a peaceful sleep, dressed, and went to open the door. "Close the office. I will not attend patients today. I have other things to do," he announced to his assistant. The investigations of that day changed the course of Dao Chen's destiny. The girls behind the bars had come from China, picked up in the street or sold by their own fathers, with the promise that they were going to the Golden Mountain to be married. Brokers selected the strongest and cheapest among them, not the most beautiful, unless it was a matter of a special order by wealthy clients who acquired them as concubines. Ah Toy, the clever woman who had invented the spectacle of the voyeuristic holes in the wall, had become the city's major importer of young flesh. For her chain of establishments, she bought girls at the age of puberty because they were easy to tame, and, after all, none lasted very long anyway. She was becoming famous and very rich. Her coffers were overflowing, and she had bought a palace in China where she planned to retire in her old age. She prided herself on being the Oriental madam with the best connections, not only among Chinese, but also influential Americans. She trained her girls to gather information, and so learned the personal secrets, political deals, and weaknesses of men who had power. If bribery failed, she had recourse to blackmail. No one dared defy her, because everyone, from the governor down, lived in a glass house. Shipments of slaves came through the docks of San Francisco with no legal tie-ups and in full light of day. Ah Toy, however, was not the only trafficker. That vice was one of the most profitable and secure business dealings in California, as golden as the mines. Expenses were minimal, the girls were cheap, and they were transported in the holds of ships in large padded crates. They lived for weeks without knowing where they were going or why. They saw daylight only when they were given lessons in their calling. During the crossing, the sailors made it their business to train them, and by the time they got off the ship in San Francisco, they had lost the last trace of innocence. Some died of dysentery, cholera, or dehydration. Others managed to jump overboard during the minutes they were taken up to the deck to be washed down with salt water. The rest were trapped. They spoke no English. They did not know that new country. They had no one to turn to. The immigration agents took bribes, turned a blind eye to the girls' obvious distress, and signed the false adoption or marriage papers without reading them. Newcomers were met at the dock by an old prostitute whose heart had turned to black stone. She herded them with a cane like cattle right through the center of the city, in plain view of anyone who wanted to look. The minute they crossed into Chinatown, they disappeared forever in the subterranean labyrinth of dark rooms, false corridors, twisting stairs, hidden doors, and double walls, where police never ventured because everything that happened there, they said, was the business of the chinks, a yellow race of perverts with whom it was best not to meddle. In an enormous below-street-level area, ironically called the Queen's Room, the girls confronted their fate. They were allowed one night's rest. They were bathed, fed, and sometimes forced to drink a cup of liquor to quiet them a little. At the hour of the auction, they were taken naked into a room crowded with buyers of every conceivable ilk, who felt them, checked their teeth, put their fingers anywhere they pleased, and finally made their offers. Some girls were sold to high-class bordellos or the harems of the rich. The strongest often ended up with factory owners, miners, or Chinese farmers, where they worked for the remainder of their brief existences. Most stayed in the cribs of Chinatown. Old whores taught them their duties. They learned to tell brass from gold so they would not be cheated, to attract clients and please them without complaint, however humiliating or painful their demands. To give the transaction an air of legality, the girls signed a contract, which they couldn't read, selling themselves for 5 years. But it was craftily calculated to ensure that they would never be free. For every day they were sick, 2 weeks were added to their time of service, and if they attempted to escape, they were enslaved for life. They lived crammed into unventilated rooms divided by heavy curtains, laboring like galley slaves until they died. It was there Dao Chen went that morning, accompanied by the spirits of Lin and his acupuncture master. An adolescent, scantily clad in a smock, led him to a filthy straw mattress behind a curtain, held out her hand, and asked him to pay first. She took his $6, lay down on her back, and spread her legs, her eyes fixed on the ceiling. Her pupils were dull, and she was breathing with difficulty. He realized she was drugged. He sat beside her, pulled down her smock, and tried to stroke her head, but she screamed and bared her teeth, ready to bite him. Dao Chen moved away. He spoke to her a long time in Cantonese without touching her, observing recent bruises, until the litany of his voice calmed her. Finally, she began to answer his questions, more with gestures than words, as if she had lost the use of language, and he learned some details of her captivity. She could not tell him how long she had been there, because counting days was a futile exercise, although it could not have been long, since she still remembered her family in China with heart-rending precision. When Dao Chen estimated that his time behind the curtain was used up, he left. The same old woman who had received him the night before was waiting at the door, but she gave no sign of recognizing him. From there, Dao went to ask questions in saloons, gambling halls, opium parlors, and then visited other physicians in the quarter, until little by little he fit together the pieces of that puzzle. When the little sing-song girls were too sick to keep working, they were taken to the hospital, as they call the secret rooms he had seen the previous night, and left there with a cup of water, a little rice, and a lamp with oil enough for a few hours. The door was opened again a few days later, when someone went in to be sure the girl was dead. If she was alive, she was killed. None ever saw sunlight again. Dao Chen had been called only because the usual Zhong Yi hadn't been available. The idea of helping the girls wasn't his, he would tell Eliza 9 months later, but Lin's and the acupuncture master's. California's a free state, Dao. Slavery is outlawed. Go to the American authorities. Not everyone enjoys freedom. White people are blind and deaf, Eliza. Those girls are invisible, like the insane and beggars and dogs. And the Chinese don't care about them. Some do, like me, but no one is willing to risk his life defying the criminal tongs. Most people believe that if things have been run that way for centuries in China, there is no reason to criticize what goes on here. But that's very cruel. It isn't cruelty. It's just that human life is not valued in my country. There are many, many people, and there are always more children than the family can feed. But in your mind, those girls aren't garbage, Dao. No. Lin and you have taught me a lot about women. What are you going to do? I should have listened when you told me to come look for gold, you remember. If I were wealthy, I would buy them. But you aren't. Besides, all the gold in California wouldn't be enough to buy every one of them. You have to stop the traffic. That's impossible. But I can save a few if you help me. Dao told Eliza that in recent months he had rescued 11 girls, but only 2 had survived. His formula was risky and not very effective, but he couldn't think of another way. He had offered to treat the girls without charge when they were sick or got pregnant, if in exchange they would hand over the dying girls to him. He bribed the old horse to call him when it was time to send a sing-song girl to the hospital. He and his assistant would go to the brothel, load the dying girl onto a stretcher, and take her away. For experiments, Dao Chen explained, although he was rarely questioned. The girl wasn't worth anything anymore, and this doctor's extravagant perversion saved the management the problem of getting rid of her. The transaction benefited both parties. Before taking the sick girl, Dao Chen would hand them a death certificate and ask for the contract she had signed so there would be no claims. In 9 instances, the girls were beyond help, and Dao's role was simply to be with them in their last hours. But 2 had lived. What did you do with them? Asked Eliza. I have them in my room. They are still weak, and one seems half crazy, but they will get well. My assistant stayed to look after them while I came to find you.
I see.
I can't keep them cooped up any longer.
Maybe we can send them back to their families in China.
No. They'll go right back to being slaves. They can be saved in this country. I just don't know how.
If the authorities won't help you, good people will. We'll go to the churches and the missionaries.
I don't think Christians are going to care about these Chinese girls.
How little you trust the human heart, Dao.
Eliza left her friend drinking tea with Joe Bonecrusher, wrapped up a loaf of freshly baked bread, and went to visit the blacksmith. She found James Morton at the anvil, sweating, naked from the waist up, wearing a leather apron and a kerchief tied around his forehead. The heat was unbearable, and the place smelled of smoke and incandescent metal. The forge was a large wood building with a dirt floor and a double door that was left open winter and summer during work hours. At the front was a large table for conducting business with customers, and behind it, the anvil. The instruments of Morton's trade hung from walls and roof beams, tools and wrought iron fashioned by Morton. At the rear, a ladder gave access to a loft that served as a bedroom, protected from the customers' eyes by an oilcloth curtain. The space below the loft was furnished with a tub for bathing and a table and two chairs. The only decorations were an American flag on the wall and three wildflowers in a vase on the table. Esther was ironing a mountain of clothes, her enormous belly bobbing and sweat pouring, but she was singing as she wielded the heavy irons. Love and pregnancy had made her beautiful, and peace lighted her like a halo. She took in washing, work as arduous as her husband's with his anvil and hammer. 3 times a week she loaded a cart with dirty clothes, went to the river, and spent a good part of the day on her knees, soaping and scrubbing. If the sun was shining, she dried the clothes on the rocks, but often she had to bring everything back wet. Then came the chore of starching and ironing. James Morton had not been able to persuade her to stop that brutal work. She did not want the baby to be born where they were and was savoring every cent to move their family to a house in town.
"Chilly boy," she cried and welcomed Eliza with a hug. "It's been a long time since you came to visit."
"How pretty you're looking, Esther. I've really come to see James," she said, handing her friend the bread. The man put down his tools, mopped sweat with his kerchief, and led Eliza to the backyard, where Esther joined them with 3 glasses of lemonade. The afternoon was cool and the sky cloudy, but there were no signs of winter. The breeze bore the scent of newly mown hay and damp earth.
Joaquin.
In the winter of 1852, the residents of Northern California ate peaches, apricots, grapes, sweet corn, watermelon, and cantaloupe, while in New York, Washington, Boston, and other important American cities, people resigned themselves to seasonal scarcities. Paulina's ships brought from Chile the delights of the Southern Hemisphere's summer, which arrived unblemished in their beds of blue ice. Her business was doing much better than her husband's and brother-in-law's gold, even though they no longer got $3 for a peach or 10 for a dozen eggs. The Chilean peasants, the Rodriguez de Santa Cruz brothers had working at their placers, had been nearly wiped out by Yankees, who had appropriated the fruit of months of work, hanged the overseers, horsewhipped and cut off the ears of several men, and run off the rest. That episode had been published in the newspapers, but the Santa Cruz family learned the hair-raising details from an 8-year-old boy, the son of one of the overseers, who had seen the white men torture and kill his father. Paulina's ships also carried theater companies from London, opera from Milan, and musical theater from Madrid, companies that played for a short while in Valparaiso and then continued north. Tickets were sold months in advance, and on performance days, San Francisco's best society, in gala finery, attended theaters where they sat beside rustic miners in work clothes. Ships did not return empty. They carried American flour, and passengers cured of the fantasy of gold, returning to Chile as poor as they had left. In San Francisco, one saw everything but old people. The population was young, strong, noisy, and brimming with health. Gold had attracted a legion of 20-year-old adventurers, but the fever had passed. However, as Paulina had predicted, the city did not turn back into a wide spot in the road. On the contrary, it kept growing, with aspirations to refinement and culture. Paulina was in her element in that ambiance. She liked the openness, the freedom, and the ostentation of that young society, exactly the opposite of the hypocrisy of Chile. She gloried in the thought of how her father would rage if he had to sit down at the table with a corrupt upstart to become a judge, or a Frenchwoman of dubious past decked out like an empress. She had grown up within the thick stucco walls and grillwork windows of her paternal home, looking toward the past, pendant on divine punishment and the opinion of others. In California, neither past nor scruples counted. Eccentricity was welcomed, and guilt did not exist as long as the offense remained hidden. Paulina wrote her sisters, with little hope that her letters would get past her father's censorship, to tell them about this extraordinary country, where it was possible to invent a new life and become a millionaire or a beggar in the wink of an eye. It was the land of opportunity, open and generous. Through the Golden Gate came masses of beings escaping poverty or violence, hoping to find work and erase the past. It wasn't easy, but their descendants would be Americans. The marvel of this country was that everyone believed their children would have a better life than theirs. Agriculture is the true gold of California. Farther than you can see are vast sown fields. Everything grows luxuriantly in this blessed soil. San Francisco has become a great city, but it has not lost the character of a frontier outpost, and that enchants me. It is still the cradle of free thinkers, visionaries, heroes, and ruffians. People come from the most remote shores. You hear 100 languages in the street, smell the food of 5 continents, see every race, she wrote. No longer a camp of solitary men, women had arrived, and with them society changed. They were as indomitable as the adventurers who came looking for gold. Crossing the continent in ox carts required a robust spirit, and these pioneer women had it. No namby-pambies like her mother and sisters. Here, Amazons like herself reigned. Day by day, they proved their mettle, competing tirelessly and tenaciously with the hardiest men. No one called them the weaker sex. Men respected them as equals. They worked in jobs forbidden to them elsewhere. They prospected for gold, worked as cowgirls, drove mules, tracked outlaws for bounty, managed gambling halls, restaurants, laundries, and hotels. Here, women can own land, buy and sell property, get divorced if they feel like it. Feliciano has to walk a fine line because the first thing he tries to get away with, I will leave him all alone and poor, Paulina joked in her letters. And she added that California had the best of the worst. Rats, fleas, weapons, and vices. People come to escape the past and begin anew, but our obsessions pursue us like the wind, Jacob Fremont wrote in a newspaper article. He himself was a good example, because changing his name, becoming a reporter, and dressing like an American had had little effect. He was the same man. The fraud of the missions in Valparaiso was behind him, but now he was devising another, and he felt, as before, that his creation was taking over, and he was irrevocably sinking into his own weaknesses. Every day came new testimonials confirming what he had written. Dozens of individuals swore they had seen Murrieta and described him exactly as the character Fremont had invented. He wasn't sure of anything anymore. He wished he had never written those stories, and at moments was tempted to retract them publicly, confess his lies, and disappear before the whole affair exploded and blew him to hell, as had happened in Chile. But he didn't have the courage to follow through. His prestige had gone to his head, and he was dizzied by fame. The story Jacob Fremont had been spinning had the earmarks of a dime novel. He wrote that Joaquin Murrieta had been an upright, noble young man, working honorably in the placers in Stanislaus, accompanied by the girl he was going to marry. When they learned of his prosperity, some Americans had attacked him, stolen his gold, beat him, and then raped his sweetheart before his eyes.
There was nothing left for the unfortunate pair but to flee, and they set out for the north, far from the gold fields. They settled down as farmers and cultivated an idyllic bit of land, surrounded by forests and fed by a limpid stream, Fremont wrote. But they were not to find peace there either, because once again Yankees came and took what was his. The couple would have to find another way to survive. Shortly afterward, Murrieta showed up in Calaveras, dealing at Monte, while his bride prepared their wedding party in the home of her parents in Sonora. It was in the stars, however, that this man would never find tranquility anywhere. He was accused of stealing a horse, and without further ado, a group of Yankees tied him to a tree and savagely lashed him in the town square. That public humiliation was more than a proud young Latino could bear, and his heart turned cold. It wasn't long before the body of a white man was found cut up in pieces like a hen for a stew, and once his parts were put back together, they recognized one of the men who had shamed Murrieta with the horsewhipping. In the following weeks, all the other participants fell one by one, each tortured and killed in some novel way. Just as Jacob Fremont wrote in his articles, never had such cruelty been seen in a land of cruel men. In the next 2 years, the name of the outlaw cropped up everywhere. His gang stole cattle and horses, ambushed stagecoaches, attacked miners in the placers and travelers on the road, defied the constables, killed any careless American they came upon, and openly mocked the law. Every unpunished crime and excess in California was attributed to Murrieta. The terrain lent itself to disappearing. There were plenty of fish and game to be had in its hills and valleys and rivers and woods. A horseman could ride for hours through the high grass without leaving a trail, and it had deep caves to take shelter in, secret mountain passes where a man could throw off pursuers. The posses that rode out to capture the wrongdoers returned empty-handed or died in their attempt. All this Jacob Fremont described with florid rhetoric, and no one thought to ask for names, dates, or places. Eliza Summers worked for 2 years in San Francisco at Dow Chien's side. During that time, she left twice during the summers to search for Joaquin Andieta, following the same procedure she had used before, joining other travelers. The first time, she went with the idea of looking until she found Andieta or until winter began, but after 4 months, she returned exhausted and ill. In the summer of 1852, she started out again, but after retracing the route she had followed previously, and later visiting Joe Bonecrusher, now thoroughly immersed in her role as Tom No Tribe's grandmother, and James and Esther, who were expecting their second child, she had returned home after 5 weeks because she couldn't stand the anguish of being away from Dao Chien. They were so comfortable in their routines, paired in their work, and as close in spirit as an old married couple. She collected everything published about Joaquin Murrieta and memorized it, as she had Miss Rose's poems when a little girl, although she tried to ignore the references to the outlaw's sweetheart. They invented that girl to sell newspapers. You know how the public is fascinated by romance, she argued to Dao Chien. On a brittle map, she tracked Murrieta's steps with the determination of a navigator, but the available information was vague and contradictory. Routes crisscrossed like the web of a demented spider, leading nowhere. Although at first she had rejected the possibility that her Joaquin was the one responsible for the blood-curdling attacks, she soon was convinced that the person jibed perfectly with the young man she remembered. He, too, had rebelled against abuses and was obsessed with helping the downtrodden. Maybe it wasn't Joaquin Murrieta who tortured his victims, but his gang, someone like that three-finger Jack whom she believed capable of any atrocity. She kept wearing men's clothing because it contributed to the invisibility so necessary in the quixotic mission Dao Chien had enrolled her in. It had been 3.5 years since she had worn a dress, and she'd had no news of Miss Rose, Mama Frisia, or her Uncle John. It seemed 1,000 years that she'd been chasing an increasingly improbable chimera. The days of the furtive embraces with her lover were long behind her. She was so caught up in her work that sometimes whole weeks went by without her remembering him, but suddenly a memory would lunge out at her and leave her trembling. Then she would look around her, confused, unable to identify the world in which she found herself. What was she doing, wearing trousers and surrounded by Chinese? She had to make an effort to shake off the confusion and remember that she was there because of the intransigence of love. Her mission was not to be helping Dao Chen, she would think, but to search for Joaquin. That was why she had come so far, and look for him she would, even if it was just to tell him face to face that he was a damned deserter and he had ruined her youth. That was her reason for having set out 3 times before. She lacked the will, however, to start again. She had gone to Dao Chen to announce her determination to take up her pilgrimage, but the words stuck like sand in her throat. She could not abandon this strange companion fate had sent her way. "What will you do if you find him?" Dao Chen had asked her once. "When I see him, I will know whether I still love him."
"And if you never find him?"
"I will live with that doubt, I suppose." Eliza had noticed a few premature gray hairs at her friend's temples. At times, the temptation to bury her fingers in that thick black hair, or her nose in his neck to get the full effect of his ocean scent, was unbearable. But now she did not have the excuse of sleeping on the ground rolled up in a blanket, and opportunities to touch one another were non-existent. Dao was working and studying too hard. She could tell how tired he must be, although he was always impeccably groomed, and kept his calm in even the most trying moments. He faltered only when he came back from a sale leading a terrified girl by the arm. He would examine her to see what condition she was in, and hand her over to Eliza with necessary instructions, then lock himself in his room for hours. "He is with Lin," Eliza would conclude, and an inexplicable pain would embed itself deep in a hidden corner of her heart. In truth, he was. In the silence of his meditation, Dao Chen would try to recover his lost aplomb and rid himself of the temptation of hatred and anger. Gradually, memories, desires, and thoughts would slip away until he felt his body dissolving into nothingness. For a time, he ceased to exist, until he reemerged transformed into an eagle, soaring effortlessly, borne by cold, limpid air that lifted him above the highest mountains. From there, he could look down on vast prairies, endless forests and rivers of pure silver. Then he knew perfect harmony, like a fine instrument resonating with the heavens and the earth. Floating among milky clouds, superb wings outstretched, he suddenly would feel Lin with him. She materialized at his side, another splendid eagle suspended in the infinite heavens. "Where is your joy, Dao?" she asked.
"The world is filled with suffering, Lin."
"Suffering fulfills a spiritual purpose."
"This is merely useless sorrow."
"Remember that the sage is always joyful because he accepts reality."
"And evil, must he accept that too?"
"The only antidote is love. And incidentally, when will you marry again?"
"I am married to you."
"I am a ghost. I cannot visit you your whole lifetime, Dao. It is very difficult to come when you call me. I do not belong in your world any longer. Marry, or you will be an old man before your time. Besides, if you do not practice the 222 positions of love, you will forget them," she teased with her unforgettable crystalline laugh.
The auctions were much worse than his visits to the hospital. There was very little hope of helping the dying girls, and if that happened, it was a miraculous gift. On the other hand, he knew that for every girl he bought, dozens were condemned to infamy. He would torture himself imagining how many he could rescue if he were wealthy, until Eliza reminded him of the ones he had saved. The two of them were joined by a delicate web of affinities and shared secrets, but also separated by mutual obsessions. The ghost of Joaquin Andieta was fading. In contrast, Lin's spirit was as detectable as the breeze or the sound of waves on the shore. All Dao Chen had to do was summon her, and she came, always smiling, as she had been in her lifetime. Far from being Eliza's rival, however, she had become her ally, although Eliza never knew that.
Lynn was the first to realize that Eliza and Dow's friendship was closer to love, and when her husband rebutted that there was no place in China or in Chile for a couple like them, she always laughed. "Do not say foolish things. The world is large and life is long. It is all a question of taking a chance." "You cannot imagine what racism is like, Lynn. You always lived among your own kind. Here no one cares what I do or what I know. To white people, I am just a revolting Chinese pagan, and Eliza is a greaser. In Chinatown, I am a renegade without a queue who dresses like an American. I don't belong anywhere."
"Racism is nothing new. In China, you and I believe that the Fan Wei were all savages."
"Here, the only thing they respect is money, and apparently, I will never have enough."
"You are mistaken. They also respect the person who commands respect. Look in their eyes."
"If I follow your advice, I will be shot at the first street corner."
"It's worth a chance to try. You complain too much, Dao. I cannot recognize you. Where is the courageous man I love?"
Dao Chen had to admit that he felt bound to Eliza by countless fine threads, each easily cut, but when twisted together, forming strands like steel. They had known each other only a few years, but they could look to the past and see the obstacle-filled road they had traveled together. Their similarities had erased differences of race.
"You look like a pretty Chinese girl," Dao had said in an unguarded moment.
"You have the face of a handsome Chilean," she had immediately answered.
They were a strange pair in the quarter, a tall, elegant Chinese man with an insignificant Spanish boy. Outside Chinatown, however, they were nearly invisible in the multifaceted throngs of San Francisco.
"You cannot wait for that man forever, Eliza. It is a form of madness, like gold fever. You must set a deadline," Dao said one day.
"And what do I do with my life when the time is up?"
"You can go back to your country.
In Chile, a woman like me is worse off than one of your sing-song girls. Would you go back to China?"
"That was my intention, but I am beginning to like America. There I would be fourth son again. I'm better off here."
"So am I. If I don't find Joaquin, I'll stay here and open a restaurant. I have everything I need. A good memory for recipes, love of the ingredients, a good sense of taste and touch, an instinct for seasonings, and modesty, too," Dao Chen laughed.
"Why should I be modest about my talent? Besides, I have a nose like a hound. A good nose should be worth something.
All I have to do is smell a dish to know what's in it and how to make it better."
"You can't do that with Chinese cooking.
You eat such strange things, Dao. Mine would be a French restaurant, the best in the city."
"I will make you a deal, Eliza. If within 1 year you do not find this Joaquin, marry me," said Dao Chen, and both burst out laughing.
After that conversation, something changed between them. They felt uncomfortable when they were alone, and although alone was what they wanted to be, they began to avoid it. The longing to follow Eliza when she went to her room often tortured Dao Chen, but he was stopped short by a blend of shyness and respect. He felt that as long as Eliza was clinging to the memory of her former lover, he should not go near her, but neither could he continue to walk a tightrope indefinitely. He imagined her in her bed, counting the hours in the expectant silence of the night, she too sleepless with love, but for another, not him. He knew her body so well that he could sketch it in detail, down to the most secret mole, even though he had not seen her naked since the days he had looked after her on the ship. He daydreamed that if she fell ill, he would have an excuse to touch her, but then he was ashamed at the thought. The spontaneous laughter and quiet tenderness that had used to bubble up between them was now replaced with oppressive tension. If they brushed against one another by accident, they pulled back, embarrassed. Each was aware of the other's presence or absence. The air seemed laden with presages and anticipation. Instead of sitting down to read or write in quiet companionship,
They parted ways as soon as work in the consulting room was finished. Dao Chen would visit bedfast patients, meet other Zhongyi to discuss diagnoses and treatments, or go to his room to study Western medical texts. He hoped to earn a permit to practice medicine legally in California, a project he had confided to no one but Eliza and the spirits of Lin and his acupuncture master. In China, a Zhongyi began as an apprentice and then worked on his own, which was why medicine hadn't changed for centuries, but had preserved the same methods and remedies. The difference between a good practitioner and one who was mediocre was that the former had a talent for diagnosing and the gift of using his hands to heal. Western doctors, however, followed a demanding program of study, kept in contact with one another, and were up to date on new discoveries. They had laboratories and morgues for experimentation and exposed themselves to the challenge of competition. Science fascinated Dao, but his enthusiasm was not seconded in a community faithful to tradition. He followed all the latest advances and bought every book and magazine he could find on those subjects. His curiosity for modern ways was so great that he had to write his venerable master's adage on the wall. Knowledge is of little use without wisdom, and there is no wisdom without spirituality. Science isn't everything, Dao repeated to himself in order not to forget. In any case, he needed American citizenship, very difficult to obtain because of his race, but that was the only way he could remain in that country without being a permanent outsider. And he needed a title. With a title, he could earn a lot more. The Fanwei knew nothing about acupuncture or the herbs used in Asia for centuries. They considered him a kind of witch doctor, and their scorn for other races was so profound that slave owners on southern plantations sent for a veterinarian when a Negro fell ill. They held the same opinion of the Chinese, but there were a few visionary doctors who had traveled or had read about other cultures and were interested in Eastern techniques and the thousand drugs and the Oriental pharmacopoeia. Dao kept in touch with Ebenezer Hobbs in England, and both lamented in their letters the great distance that separated them. "Come to London, Dr. Chen, and give an acupuncture demonstration to the Royal Medical Society. You will leave them open-mouthed, I promise you," Hobbs wrote. He had always said that if they combined their knowledge, they would be able to raise the dead. An unusual pair. Several Singsong girls died of pneumonia from the winter cold, and Dao Chen couldn't save them. Twice he was called while the girls were still alive. He managed to get them home, but they died in his arms a few hours later, delirious with fever. By then, the quiet tentacles of his compassion had spread across North America, from San Francisco to New York, from the Rio Grande to Canada. But that extraordinary effort was only a grain of salt in an ocean of misery. Things were going well in his practice, and everything he was able to save or obtain through the charity of a few wealthy patients went toward buying the youngest girls in the auctions. He was recognized now in that subculture and had the reputation of being a degenerate. No one had ever seen alive any of the adolescents Dao acquired for his experiments, as he called them, but no one really cared what happened behind his closed doors. As a Zhongyi, he was the best. As long as he did not create a scandal and limited himself to the little whores, who were no more than animals anyway, they left him in peace. In answer to curious questions, Dao Chen's loyal assistant, the only person qualified to give information, said only that his employer's mysterious experiments resulted in the exceptional knowledge that was so beneficial for his patients. By that time, Dao Chen had moved to a fine house on the edge of Chinatown, a few blocks from Union Square, where he held his clinic, sold his remedies, and hid the girls until they were able to travel. Eliza had learned the rudiments of Chinese necessary for communicating on an elementary level. The rest she improvised with pantomime, drawings, and a few words of English. The effort was rewarding. It was much better than posing as the doctor's deaf-mute brother. She could not write or read Chinese, but she recognized the medicines by their smell, and as a safeguard, she marked the bottles with a code of her own invention.
There were always patients waiting for the gold needles, the miraculous herbs, and the comfort of Dao Qian's voice. More than one asked himself how that man who was so wise and affable could be the person who collected corpses and child concubines. But as they were not absolutely sure what his vices consisted of, the community respected him. He had no friends, it was true, but neither did he have enemies. His good name spread beyond the confines of Chinatown, and some American doctors consulted him when their knowledge was insufficient, always very quietly, for it would have been embarrassing to admit that a celestial had anything to teach them. That was how Dao had occasion to treat certain important figures in the city and to meet the celebrated Ah Toy. The madam had summoned Dao Qian when she heard that he had helped the wife of a judge. She was suffering a rattle like castanets in her lungs, so bad that at times it threatened to choke her. Dao Qian's first impulse was to refuse, but principle was overshadowed by his curiosity to see at close hand the legend and her surroundings. In his eyes, she was a viper, his personal enemy. Knowing what Ah Toy represented for Dao, Eliza put enough arsenic in his bag to dispatch a team of oxen. "Just in case," she explained. "Just in case what?" "She may be very sick. You wouldn't want her to suffer, would you? Sometimes you have to help someone die." Dao Qian laughed heartily, but did not remove the bottle from his satchel. Ah Toy received him in one of the deluxe retreats, where the client paid $1,000 a session, but always left satisfied. "Besides," she maintained, "if you need to ask the price, this is not the place for you." A negress in a starched uniform opened the door to Dao and took him through several drawing rooms where beautiful girls in silk robes were lounging. Compared with their less fortunate sisters, they lived like princesses. They ate 3 times a day and had daily baths. The house, a true museum of Oriental antiques and American conveniences, reeked of tobacco, stale perfumes, and dust. It was 3 in the afternoon, but the heavy drapes were drawn. No breeze ever freshened those rooms. Ah Toy was sitting in a small study crammed with furniture and bird cages. She was much smaller, younger, and more beautiful than Dao had imagined. She was carefully made up, but she wore no jewels, was simply dressed, and eschewed the long fingernails that indicated wealth and leisure. His eyes were drawn to her minuscule sandal-shod feet. Her gaze was penetrating and hard, but she spoke in a caressing tone that reminded Dao of Lin. "Damn her," Dao Qian sighed, defeated with her first word. He was impassive as he examined her, cloaking his repugnance and agitation, not knowing what to say to her because to lecture her for trafficking was not only futile, it was dangerous and would call attention to his own activities. He prescribed Ma Huang for her asthma and other remedies for cooling her liver, curtly warning her that as long as she lived closed up behind those drapes, smoking tobacco and opium, her lungs would continue to wheeze. The temptation to leave the poison with instructions to take one pinch daily flitted past like a nocturnal butterfly, and he shivered, shocked by that instant of doubt, because until then he had believed he would never be angry enough to kill anyone. He left hurriedly, certain that in view of his rudeness, the woman would never call him again. "Well," asked Eliza on his return, "nothing." "What do you mean, nothing? Not even a little tuberculosis. She won't die." "We are all going to die. That snake will die an old woman. She is as strong as a buffalo. Most evil people are." As for Eliza, she knew that she was at a definitive fork in her road, and that the direction she chose would determine the rest of her life. Dao Qian was right. She had to set a deadline. She couldn't ignore any longer the suspicion that she had fallen in love with love and was trapped in the morass of a legendary passion with no link to reality. She tried to remember the feelings that had driven her to embark on this consuming adventure, but she couldn't. The woman she had become had little in common with the moonstruck girl of the past. Valparaiso and the Room of the Armoires belonged to a different time, to a world that was disappearing in the mist.
She asked herself 1,000 times why she had hungered so desperately to belong body and soul to Joaquin Andieta, when in truth she had never been totally happy in his arms and could explain it only in terms of first love. She had been ready to fall in love when he came to the house to unload some cargo. The rest was instinct. She had merely obeyed the most powerful and ancient of calls, but it had happened an eternity ago and 7,000 miles away. Who was she then, and what had she seen in him she could not say, only that now her heart was far away from there? Not only was she tired of looking for him, but deep down she did not want to find him. At the same time, though, she could not go on riddled with doubts. She needed an ending for that phase in order to begin a new love with a clean slate. By the end of November, her anxiety was too great, and without a word to Dao Chen, she visited the newspaper office to speak with the famous Jacob Fremont. She was taken to the editorial room where several journalists were working at their desks, surrounded by appalling disorder. They pointed to a small office behind a glass-paned door, and she went in. She stood before the desk, waiting for the Yankee with red sideburns to look up from his papers. He seemed to be about medium height, with freckled skin, and had a faint aroma of candles. He was writing with his left hand, and his head was propped on his right. She could not see his face, but then, beneath the scent of beeswax, she perceived a familiar odor that carried a vague, distant childhood memory. She bent slightly toward him, discreetly sniffing. At the very instant, the newspaper man looked up. Surprised, they stared at each other from uncomfortably close quarters, then simultaneously drew back. Eliza recognized him from his scent, despite the years, the eyeglasses, the sideburns, and the American garb. Miss Rose's perennial suitor. The same Englishman who had faithfully attended the Wednesday musicals in Valparaiso. Paralyzed, she could not escape. "What can I do for you, young fellow?" asked Jacob Todd, removing his eyeglasses to clean them with his handkerchief. The speech Eliza had prepared was wiped from her brain. She stood with her mouth open, hat in hand, sure that since she had recognized him, he would know her. But he carefully fitted his glasses back on and repeated the question without looking at her.
"It's about Joaquin Murrieta," she stammered, her voice squeaking higher than usual.
"You have information about that outlaw?" The newspaper man was immediately interested.
"No, no, just the opposite. I came to ask you about him. I need to see him."
"You remind me of someone, kid. Haven't we met somewhere?"
I don't think so, senor."
"Are you Chilean?"
"Yes."
"I lived in Chile some years ago. Beautiful country. Why do you want to see Murrieta?"
"It's very important."
"I'm afraid I can't help you. No one knows his whereabouts."
"But you have talked with him."
"Only when Murrieta summons me. He gets in touch with me when he wants some episode of his published. Nothing modest about the man. He likes his fame."
"What language do you use when you talk?"
"My Spanish is better than his English."
"Tell me, senor, is his accent Chilean or Mexican?"
I couldn't say. I repeat, kid, I can't help you," the journalist replied, standing to indicate the end of the conversation, which was beginning to annoy him. Eliza quickly said goodbye, and Fremont stood with a quizzical look, watching as she picked her way through the uproar of the editorial room. That boy looked familiar, but he couldn't place him. Several minutes later, after his visitor had vanished, Fremont remembered Captain John Summers' request, and the image of young Eliza flashed through his memory. Then he connected the name of the outlaw with that of Joaquin Andieta and understood why she was asking. He choked back a groan and ran outside, but Eliza had disappeared.